It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today. Rabbi Jeremy Parnes has been the rabbi at Regina's Beth Jacob Synagogue for a little over a year, but his connection with the congregation goes back much farther than that. Rabbi Parnes was born and raised in a Jewish Orthodox home in London, England. He sang in a synagogue choir and attended a Jewish boarding school. He came to Canada about 35 years ago, living in Toronto, then London, Ontario, before being transferred to Regina, where he left the company to pursue other business interests. So, Rabbi Parnes, welcome.
Thank you, Henry. Good morning. It's a beautiful day. In here, anyway. Watch and see what happens. By this afternoon, this beauty will emanate outside, and the temperature will be down much more. Or is that up? Yeah, exactly. I've always maintained that since I've lived here, I've never been... It's not the cold that bothers me. It's the fact that at some point it goes to -1 and I feel warm. I find that a concern. I thank you for that hymn that you chose this morning, that song. The result, of course, by the third verse, we're beginning to get it. And this gives me another understanding of why there are 8 days in Hanukkah. So if you adopt the eight-day concept, within 8 days, you'll get it perfectly. So this morning, I've been asked to speak about Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, which is actually, it was never called Hanukkah originally, it was called the Festival of Lights. I'm going to talk, first of all, about the sort of the simple understanding of the festival. Is this okay? Is this comfortable? If I stand back a little bit, it sounds like I'm giving you a little bit of hiss or feel. It's okay? Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, commemorates an event that took place around 165 BC or BCE, before the Common Era, or before Christ, depending on your belief system. Let's put it another way. It occurred about 2,178 years ago. and it occurred at a time when the Seleucid Greeks, under the Seleucid Greek general... Okay, let's go from... I guess we should start with Alexander. Alexander the Great had this amazing empire, and for some reason, at the age of 32, hadn't done any succession planning, and he died. And his three generals... split the empire amongst themselves. And so there was the Ptolemaic Empire that stretched through Egypt and around that area. There was the Seleucid Empire that was into Persia and included Israel. And there was the Antigonids. And the Seleucid Empire didn't originally have Israel as part of its geography. It was actually originally under the Ptolemaic general. Over time, they kept fighting about this little piece of land. Very unusual to that they should fight over Israel. I don't understand. It's that kind of geography, for whatever reason, and continues to be the case. And when it became under the control of the Seleucid Greeks, the Assyrian Greeks, the concept, that was 323 that Alexander passed away, so that's 2,350 years ago. Over time, those rulers, there was Antiochus III, Epiphany, who had a connection with Hellenism that was much stronger than it had been before. In other words, when Alexander conquered the country, he said, well, you're ours, but you can still continue to worship the way you worship. It got to a point that we were very Hellenized as a country over the years, and there was a strong Hellenistic philosophy that it found itself within the Israeli and Jewish population of the time, as well, of course, as our faith and culture and so forth. And there became a little bit of an antagonism. Between the one and the other. At some point, Antiochus IV, who succeeded the third, said, enough, you're going to worship the way we worship, we're going to Hellenize the country, end of subject, because we don't need these back and forths. That was the concept. I would argue there may be some other reasons, but we'll get to that. The Greek, his army came in, they took they controlled the country, went into Jerusalem, took the temple, and placed their gods, Zeus, etc., their idols, in the temple. And I believe they also worshipped, made sacrifices, offerings, and their offerings would have been pigs, would have been offered as sacrifice, which of course would have been for us even more of a desecration. And at that point, the family of Kohanim, of priests, that were very, very prevalent at that time, were Mattathias and his five sons. And Mattathias was of the Maccabee clan of priests, and he stood up against this general, Antiochus, or this king now, Antiochus the Fourth. And when the Antiochus said, "You're going to bow before me, before our gods and our sacrifices," Mattathias said, "No, I'm not." I don't know where he got the sword from, but he stood up and decided to get into a fight. And that got the usual nationalistic pride going, and the people rose up with him, and there was a civil war against the Greeks, the Greek army. You with me so far? Nothing's very simple with these things. That's what happened. The result was remarkable. Mattathias had died after about a year. His son, the youngest, Judah HaMaccabee, the Maccabee meaning hammer, Judah the hammer, Yehuda in Hebrew, led the forces and successfully threw the Greeks out of the temple, and ultimately they took back control of their holdings. And so that meant that they could reconsecrate the temple to their monotheistic belief in one God, in the one God, true God that we believe in. And they, in order to do that, needed to light what's called the Ner Tamid. It's funny how light pervades through everything. Needed to light the Ner Tamid. The Ner Tamid, Ner means light, Tamid, always. Literally. So it's the eternal light, which was supposed to burn 365 days of the year without fail. And that was comprised, of course, using olive oil, and that's how the light was kept burning. They would continue to top it up with olive oil. The trouble was that the only holy olive oil that they could find, because you could only use virgin olive oil, pure olive oil, there are those who believe that the way they pressed for this purpose was they would put them into a vat, and the weight of the olives one upon the other, rather than pressing, the weight of themselves produced a pressing. So this was, I mean, major. You can imagine how much work it would have taken to do that. And that oil was the holy oil. They found when they reconsecrated the temple that there was one cruse of oil that would be enough for one day if they lit it. And so the first thing that happened was, we imagine there ensued a big argument. Do we light it? Do we wait? What should we do? And the decision was, we should light the light, have some faith, and let's get on with finding some more, making more oil. And it takes about 8 days to make more oil. They lit the light, and the miracle that we celebrate of Hanukkah is the light stayed lit for the 8 days until there was more holy oil. That's Hanukkah. And so from that point on, it was commemorated, it was decided rabbinically, if you will, that from this point on, we would commemorate the miracle. Nes Gadol Hayasham, here, Nes Gadol Hayapo, a great miracle happened here, and that was the miracle of light. I like that because it takes the focus off of all the war and the fighting and the bloodshed, which really is not the most exciting thing in the world. And in keeping with the principles of Unitarianism, I think that it pleases me as well that we focus on the light. It happens that the light of Hanukkah occurs, in fact, not on the 27th of November, which is the lighting of the first light this year, but on the 25th of Kislev, which is our calendar month that we observe. And because we follow a lunar calendar, it never completely falls on the same day as the solar calendar, right? So we do make adjustments with leap years. So it comes around that time. Every so often it'll fall on the 25th of December, which will explain, or around that time, which will explain why so many times I'm asked to speak in schools and explain how Jewish people celebrate Christmas. The nice thing is it brings light into the world. Rabbinically, the questions were, okay, so we have Hanukkah, we'll celebrate accordingly. But the question is, and this is typical rabbis, I own up to it, I confess, always has to be a big discussion about the exact process of how does one celebrate and commemorate. And the answer is that the two schools prevailing at that time of rabbis were Hillel and Shammai. And the school of Shammai said, what we should do is on the first day we'll light 8 candles, and on the second day 7 candles, on the third day 6 candles, and so on, until the end of the festival, the lights, we wind it down, in other words. And Hillel said, no, on the first day we'll light 1 candle, on the second day we'll light 2 candles. So that was the second revolution that took place. No. So the discussion went back and forth, and the overwhelming decision amongst the people and the other rabbis was that we would follow the Hillel concept, which 95% of the time is what we tend to do with all rulings of that time. We follow Hillel rather than Shammai. And so on the first day, we light 1 candle. On the second day, 2. I was bringing a menorah this morning to light it and just to sort of be a part of that process. And it's sitting on my counter at home. I put it down for a minute and forgot to bring it in. But there you have 8 candles, actually. Now, to give you an understanding of just how precise we get, Hanukkah is to advertise the miracle. So not only do we do these things, we also sing songs that speak to that. We sing a song called Mo'atzu Yeshuati Lachana El Shabeya. Mo'atzu Yeshuati. Mo'atzu, Rock of Ages. You may know it in the English. And we also read a story within our liturgy, in praise of what happened. This miracle that took place during the Hanukkah period, and sing psalms. So it's a lovely, sort of bright, upbeat festival. We celebrate by therefore also having parties at houses all over the city. I was doing like 3 a day for a while there. And the problem with that, I mean, nice, yes, the problem with it is that we celebrate by eating things that have been cooked in oil. In Israel, the tradition is to eat sufganiyot, which is deep-fried donuts that are amazing and delicious. And in North America, the tradition is to eat latkes, which is a form of potato pancake, but not quite, something like that. There are a number of different recipes that are also very delicious. But it takes about 6 months to get the smell out of the house from the cooking of this stuff. And wherever you go, when you get home, you have to take your clothes off outside and then come in, because otherwise it contaminates the whole house. It's just one of those things. But a wonderful concept. And so we just wholeheartedly embrace it regardless. Oh. Never mind the weight. What about the heartburn? Everybody says kosher is about being sort of such a healthy diet. Think again. Okay, so these are some of the things we do. In addition, we became the habit of creating a game for the kids called a dreidel. The game is called playing dreidel, and the dreidel is the spinning top that has 4 sides on it, and on each side is a Hebrew letter. And that says Nes Gadol Hayasham, the first letter of each of those words, meaning a great miracle happened there in Jerusalem. In Israel, of course, it says Nes Gadol Hayapo, a great miracle happened here. So there's 2 different gradles. And so the kids play, and they play for money. We gamble, but it's chocolate money. Hanukkah gelt is chocolate money, so it's those little chocolates with gold. And they learn the meaning of the phrase and what Hanukkah is about. And then when we go to these parties, everybody brings their own menorah, their own Hanukkiah, and everybody lights it at the same time, which can be a problem if you've got sort of smoke detectors and things. But otherwise, it's not a problem at all. And you're supposed to advertise the miracle. So therefore, usually, not here, we would put it outside our front door so people can see the miracle that we're advertising. Here we look for a window that we can put the candles in because it's just a little too cold to go outside with it. And so I'm trying to think what other elements of... Oh, yes. And so because, of course, it's 8 days, we have a candelabrum that has how many? Eight. Nope. Nothing's that easy in Judaism. Sorry. I'm a rabbi. We can't do it simple. We have to make it complicated. We have 9 branches on a menorah. There you go. And any menorah to be kosher, fit, or acceptable has to have 9 branches. All 8 branches of the 8 days have to be in the same line together, and the 9th in a different, either up or out from the other 8. The reason for this is because in the days when we first commemorated, we didn't have electricity. Most of them used oil, of course, before candles, and then we had candles. The problem was that we also worked by light, by candlelight. And the idea was that you can't use a menorah to do work because it's exclusively designed to celebrate the miracle. I love that idea that, you know, don't do that because you're missing the point when you do that. It'll lose its sense. And so you have to only light the candles for the benefit of the miracle. They cannot be used for any other purpose. And that means you can't use one to light the other. So we have the 9th candle, which we call the worker candle, the shamash, which works to do the lighting of the other candles. And that's why we have 9 instead of 8, even though it's an 8-day festival. Okay. In our community, we celebrate with parties. In our synagogue on Sunday, the 1st of December, which was the 4th day of Pesach, I believe, of Chanukah, I believe, we had a big gathering at the synagogue. And there were a big gathering, about 150, 175 people. And we light the candles, and the kids sing, and we have a Hanukkah play, and we make latkes and sufganiyot. And it's just a lot of fun. So this is not a religious event. It's a symbolic event. And it's not a biblically ordained event, of course, because it happened after that. It's a rabbinically ordained event. However, the question arises, there's always a however. Is this okay? Okay. If you have questions, you can ask. I like discussion. Oh, okay, great. I can even walk with this, I presume.
Thank you.
Okay, good. I can even walk with this if you like.
Should I give this one to Jeremy or keep this one?
How am I doing for time?
You're doing fine.
Lots of time? You sure? Okay. All right, so first of all, do you have any questions? There's no point in worrying about it if there's no questions at this point.
Will be questions.
Yeah, and I, you know, at the same time, I'm happy to walk around. And in fact, why don't I do that?
Okay.
Get closer. It feels more comfortable.
Yeah, that last remark you made about not biblically
ordained,
but rabbinically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not in the what we call the Old Testament.
No.
It's not.
No.
Okay.
Because the Old Testament is the 5 books of Moses.
Oh, just that.
The Torah.
Right.
So if you look at the Tanakh, which is the Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, the Torah, the writings, as well, Ketuvim, and the Chronicles, Kings, Prophets, etc., Proverbs, Psalms, all of those things, this all happened after that. The time of Maccabees happened after that. About the time of Daniel, actually.
So what is the name of that section, that book?
So thank you. Good question. That brings me to where I was just going. I will hold it there for one moment and I will come back.
No, yes. Go ahead.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay, you got it. So, the interesting thing is, how do we know it's Hanukkah? Because we don't have it in any of our books. There's almost no reference to Hanukkah in any of our canon. Right? Hanukkah appears in Maccabees 1 and 2. And Maccabees 1 and 2 is in the new canon, not the old canon. It's in the Christian Testament. The book of Maccabees is not in our canon.
Hmm.
There you go. Front page news right away. There you go. It's a complete, well, I mean, it's interesting. Nobody thinks about this. Nobody knows this. It is not in our canon. So then becomes the question, why not? Point one. I mean, it's a valid point. And how do we remember it if it's not there? I mean, how do we realize it? So there are those who believe we remember it because it was commemorated right at that point, became very popular, being a festival of lights. It tends to draw people. Even today, it's become very, very popular amongst less religious Jews, people who are not observant as well as those who do observe. If they don't observe anything else, they'll observe Hanukkah. Interestingly enough, it's a simple festival. It doesn't require some of the other elements that religious festivals for us require, which can be quite onerous for many people. You know, not driving, not smoking, not cooking, not doing a whole bunch of things. These are things that happen on day of rest if you strictly observe it, not striking, not making light, making fire or anything like that. So when you understand how our process works, it's a beautiful concept how we do things, but it can be very difficult if it doesn't fit with your daily lives, you know, in regular society in the 21st century.
So another question. At that time, I gather the focus of the Jewish religion was the temple and the temple priests.
Correct.
In coming to offer sacrifice and so forth.
Yes.
And you've referred to rabbinic Judaism being evident quite a bit before the change of the Common Era.
Yes.
So how did rabbinic Judaism evolve and start, and
what was
its focus as opposed to, say, the temple and the priests and people having to go to the temple to offer sacrifice?
Talk about making me work here. This is perfectly mark. So let me give you a little bit of a sense of this. First of all, we were a sacrificial cult right up until the destruction of the Second Temple in Roman times, 70 of the Common Era, or 70 AD, you might say. Okay, but up until then, we were a sacrificial cult. For a couple of hundred years before that, there were already itinerant preachers wandering through the communities, preaching, writing liturgy. Many of those liturgies now continue on in our prayer books today. By the time of Ezra the Scribe, which was 2,700, 2,600 years ago, we were already reading the Torah in its entirety out in public to the people, usually on market days, etc. So things were beginning to evolve in different ways even then. At the time of Hellenism was very attractive to many people who could see philosophy and concepts of that nature being very much in keeping with discussions of Torah as well, because Torah for us is also how to live well in community. So you can actually study, as I was mentioning to a few people this morning, you can actually study Torah in a secular way, not a religious way, inverted commas. And I'm teaching it that way right now in my synagogue. And so there evolved a point, especially with all the oppressions as well, where people started to ask the question, why should we be well behaved? The Torah says, do things right, be a good person, all that good stuff. Make laws. The laws are there to help people because, you know, your idea of right and somebody else's idea of right is not always the same, right? So, you know, you need some kind of impartial ruling that says this is what it is, how you do it, this is how you resolve it. And so those are the laws of the Torah, essentially, with then commentary afterwards, discussion according to changing times. We ran into a problem. So if that's true, and if that means that, you know, if we live well, we will be rewarded, what's the reward? We're being crucified here. We're being killed here. Exactly what's our reward? It came to points of persecution over the thousands of years that someone finally turned around and said, there has to be, either this is all wrong, or there has to be something else. Somebody came up with the concept of reward in the hereafter. If you read the Old Testament, the five books of Moses, it never refers to reward in the hereafter. It never refers to another existence. He died and he slept with his ancestors is a very common term. So the Sadducees, who were the priestly clan, and they were called the Sadducees because at that time the main priestly family was the priestly family of Zadok. So Zadduzim, they were the Sadducees, became a political party, as it were. The politics of that system was, that's the way it is, and it's literal, and it's specifically to the point of Torah. And there are those going, doesn't make sense. I'm living well, and I'm being beaten up, and I'm being crucified. Must be something else. And that was the beginning of the concept of messianics that was created by the precursor to the rabbis called the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the learned class. They weren't the higher aristocracy of the priests, because the priests were the aristocratic clan. They earned their stripes by, like kings did. You were born into it. The Levites, yes? The Pharisees earned it by studying and discussing the Old Testament and making commentary, and they became very, very learned judges and commentators. And that ultimately became the rabbis. They originated somewhere in there the concept of Messiah. The idea that the answer is, we're not being treated well here because it's a test. Right? Our reward is in the world to come, and at some point the world will be perfected, and when that happens, the Messiah, this agent of God, will walk the earth and bring everybody to peace, and it'll be resolved. That's kind of in simple terms. Yes? Okay. That's the beginning of messianic concepts. We still believe in Messiah, right? It's just that we don't believe he came yet. That's the singular difference between Christianity and Judaism, from which all the other things come, right? The competitiveness. But the truth is, that's it. We both believe the Messiah will come. One believes it's going to come again, and the other believes it hasn't been yet, but will come. Yeah, boy. Oy. Okay, so you see the two, now we have two very political outshoots from this concept. And the Pharisees became the ones that the people really followed. And so we begin to see a situation where the priestly clan started to lose its unique, singular, number one position. So much so that it came to the point that the Pharisees appointed who the priests would be from the priestly clans. That's historically what started to happen. Yes?
That's very interesting, because we just had a thing about Jesus and about the conflict between the Pharisee Saul and his version of Christianity and the priestly version that was in Jerusalem after the temple was crushed and Jerusalem was dispersed. But anyway, so it totally follows what we just did last week about it's amazing in terms of just history of Judaism and Christianity.
Well, and Jesus and Saul would have been Pharisees.
Saul was a Pharisee.
Yeah, I mean,
he brought in this Pauline version of Christianity,
yeah, absolutely,
which conflicted totally with the rebellious, rebellious Judaism in this world. You know. Anyway, my question was political 20th century, 21st century. I remember when we studied I think it's called, I'm not quite sure, Beth Shavuot, something like that, the festival of renewal at springtime and this kind of stuff in Judaism.
Pesach?
No.
Or Shavuot?
Yes, Shavuot.
Feast of Weeks.
Yes, and at that time I read that it was celebrated, it's quite a different meaning in today's Israel and does in other parts, like especially North America. Much more political, much more nationalistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the same thing happens with Hanukkah. It's that sort of, is the context different in Israel versus North America?
Not really. Because there is no temple anymore. So there's no priests to argue with. So instead we have 32, actually 70 different political parties, and they all argue and you know, so forth. But we're very, very to the point of democracy, to the point of amazing. But it doesn't exist anymore. Thank God for the rabbis. And I'm not saying that because I'm a rabbi. If the priests continued to maintain their hold in the way that they had it, at the time of the Romans, once the temple was destroyed, we were done. That was the end of the sacrificial cult that we were. It was a rabbi by the name of Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was friendly with the general, the Roman general, or one of the Roman generals in Israel at the time, in Jerusalem, in fact, who said, "We know what's going to happen. We know this is going. This is before the destruction of the temple." He had a conversation that said, "We know that what will happen. I want to ask a favor of you. I only want that you will allow me to take a little bit of a piece of land. It's a dust bowl called Yavne, Jamnia, I think it's called it's pronounced in English, but Yavne, north of Jerusalem. It's a dust bowl. If you would let us set up a school there, that would be wonderful." And the general said, "Sure." So he gave him his space, and he started to renew the faith after the destruction of the temple. And his renewal of the faith was, we no longer are a sacrificial cult, we are a penitential cult. We are making penitence for what we've done that resulted in the loss of the temple. And that was the beginning of rabbinic Judaism that we see today. It came out of the Pharisees. Well, the synagogues themselves started to come out a couple of hundred years before, but they weren't synagogues. They were guys walking, wandering around. After a while, they started to settle in and started to do their own thing. And then Yavne became a center for liturgical and Torahitic teaching and study, and they would branch out and start to send people out, and they would set up places, and so it started to renew itself and develop. And that's how it all, in a nutshell.
I have a feeling that this is going to have to be the last question because of time, so it might be a very appropriate one to ask a rabbi. It is my understanding that you don't become a Jew, you are born a Jew.
Absolutely. There's a very good question, and it's a unique and important difference. I was born a Jew, so I didn't have any choice in the matter. I was, at 8 days, my father made sure I was circumcised, which is interesting because as I teach during the circumcision ceremony that I conduct, that please note that when a father does this or authorizes a doctor to do that or someone to do it, he's essentially affirming his own circumcision because he couldn't have done it at 8 days of age. But he's doing it in his son, right? All of those things happen regardless. I'm supposed to observe because we are the holders of the covenant. That's our chosenness. That's it. Nothing more. And so, looking at time, I think we're running out.
Are you happy with one Christian?
Whatever you would like. I don't want to take away from you.
You can finish it at 11:30. Is that good enough for you?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
So. I have to leave at 11:45. How's that?
Okay, that's fine.
Is this okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, actually, it's not really related to Hanukkah. It's I'm just wondering about young people now in the Jewish community. Are you losing young people? And if not, how are you involving young people?
The answer is yes, we are, and at the same time, they come back. So it's based on the very question that you asked me. What happens when you're born a Jew? At some point, you hit an age where you start to say, "So that's not fair." And you go in search. There are many Boo-Jews out there, Jews who go to Buddhism, for example, and other and experience other things. As we call them, Boo-Jews. And I did the same thing. What I did was I left my faith completely. I explored other faiths. If I had not come back, I became a humanist. If I had not come back to Judaism, I likely would have been a member of this congregation right here. What can I say? Sorry about that. but at some point, I couldn't deny how I felt, so it changed, and I became not just a Jew by birth, but a Jew by choice. And that is what I am. And in what I learned from that is that the fear that people have of sharing and discussing and learning about each other you know, whether it's Jews and Christians or Muslims or Hindus, it doesn't matter, although Hindus is not an issue. I never experienced any sort of pushback from Hinduism. But with our politics, with Judaism and Christianity and Judaism and Islam, etc., what I've learned is that I can sit in a church all day. I'm never going to become a Christian. It's nothing personal. It's just not in my DNA. And I'm guessing if that's true for me, it's probably true for everybody else in one form or another, yes? And so I'm no longer afraid of those things and rather prefer to share them. So last week I spoke at New Hope Lutheran Church. And my point to them, aside from everything else, was at some point we need to come to a realization that it's not about respecting our similarities. It's not about finding all the things that are sameness for us. It's about finding all the things that aren't the same and respecting our differences. That's the challenge that I believe, and I believe in the divine, and that's the challenge that divine brings us. And at some point, hopefully, we'll all get on the same page for that. Having said that, it's still not so easily done, but it is a worthy goal.
I assume that you do get people who
convert to Judaism?
Yes.
And what's the story on that?
We try to discourage it. We do. Well, to be honest, why would you want to be Jewish? That's always the question I ask. When somebody says to me, I want to be a Jew, I'm going, what the heck would you do that for? I mean, first of all, you want to be persecuted? I mean, I knew how much I was beaten up growing up as a kid and with the names I was called. I'm not alone in this. There are plenty of other faiths and cultures and that have experienced the same thing. But the question is, why do it? Point one. Point two, you don't have to be Jewish to go to heaven, from our perspective. Just be a good person. And you can come to the synagogue and enjoy our services anytime you like. So why would you want to be Jewish? So someone really has to go deep and find a reason for that. And then they have to study for a couple of years. So don't make it easy.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. I think we'll probably leave it there.
No problem.
So we've got time to wrap up properly.
Okay, yes. Maybe if I can, I'll just close by saying Hanukkah is a festival of thanksgiving. Judah the Maccabee, Yehuda means to give thanks. And Judaism, Jews, Yehudim, are people who give thanks, I hope. Thank you.